Well, even the words that you use non-medically, right? So you would, quite often you end up with you did, believe it or not, way back when you did learn suffixes and prefixes in grade 2 or grade 3, somewhere in there. You've just completely forgotten that you did it. My big problem is nouns, pronouns, verbs, adverbs, conjunctions. I don't remember any of that stuff anymore. I don't even think they teach it anymore, do they? Does anybody know what a conjunction is? No. You didn't what? What slide? Kind of, I'm going to review it because I got to get everybody's brain back into what we're going to talk about. Yeah, I know. We didn't quite finish this. No, you didn't have to study this. You weren't here last week. You didn't hear me say that there would be no questions on this in the test. No, the week before, I told everybody. I'm not. I did this 2 weeks ago and I said it's not going to be on the test, only tissues. I did say that. Yeah, but no, I did say this specifically because I didn't teach it. I don't examine what I don't teach. So, as a reminder, mitochondria, remember a few key points here. Obviously, this is the area where ATP is created, and that's what we're going to be talking about eventually. That's why I'm reviewing over this, just to remind yourself. Another key point is there are two membranes in the mitochondria. There is a smooth outer shell and a convoluted inner shell, right? So it has a two lipid bilayer membrane that's very similar to the plasma membrane. Although artists do draw pictures in anatomy books and show one mitochondria, it's not unusual for a cell to have 1,000 mitochondria in there. Why? Because that cell likely requires lots of NATP, S3 ATP. Right. Okay, so it depends on what the cell is. So the outer one is smooth. The inner is thrown into a series of folds known as cristae. Of course, these cristae, and anytime you see convolutions or infoldings, whatever the term may be used, it's always increasing surface area. So by folding things within things, you're increasing surface area immensely, but you're allowing it to fit into a small package. The fluid within the folds is called the mitochondrial matrix. So you can see that kind of in blue here. You can see the two membranes as an outer smooth and an inner convoluted. Now, on the surface of the cristae, remember the cristae are these convolutions that we see here, okay? On the surface of those are a group of enzymes known as oxidative phosphorylation enzymes, which we'll be getting into. Fundamentally, though, we require oxidative phosphorylation enzymes to take and create ATP. They are required to create this ATP we're talking about. Within the inner cavity of the mitochondria is a matrix which contains another group of enzymes, and they are a group of enzymes that control chemical reactions known as the citric acid cycle or the Krebs cycle, which we'll be talking about today. Basically, what it does, it takes the energy that we find in food sources, hence, a food source you all know is sugars, right? Carbohydrates. You get that from bananas, apples, white sugar, honey, maple syrup, whatever. There's energy in that sugar, and that energy gets utilized to create this ATP molecule to provide energy to all the workings within a cell. Think of ATP as gasoline for the motor, for the engine. That's basically what's happening. So, of course, because we require oxygen to create this ATP, this is known as the site of cellular respiration, simply because it utilizes the gas or the molecule O2 in order to create this ATP. So we can see it here. We will be talking about these. So here we can see the outer smooth membrane. In here we can see sort of a portion of a cristae, and we can see all the processes by which we're going to create ATP. We have the Krebs cycle here, which we'll be talking about today, but we also have a few steps that occur here, and this is known as the electron transport chain. Okay, and fundamentally, the Krebs cycle really isn't responsible for the majority of ATP that's created. It's actually the electron transport chain at the end of the day. And as a little throw out there, it is the Krebs cycle that creates materials that the electron transport chain uses to create ATP. The Krebs cycle does create a couple of ATP, but nowhere near what the electron transport chain does. The other thing I told you that the theory is that the mitochondria in a single cell kind of got together and felt that if they worked together, they'd be better off to survive. So the mitochondria entered into the cell and everything worked out the way that it did, and that's kind of why we're all here. But the reason they speculate this is because we do find that mitochondria actually contain their own DNA, and they can replicate themselves if required at any given time when a cell requires ATP production. So we can see here, here's our cristae, we've got our smooth outer, our convoluted inner, we've got our cristae here, and we can see all the matrix sort of in between and so forth. So metabolism, we say the metabolism is all chemical reactions in the body, and they can either be anabolic or catabolic. We have to remember that anabolic is building things and catabolic is breaking things down. The molecule that is most often used in energy exchange, of course, as I said, adenosine triphosphate, better known as ATP. And it couples energy release and catabolism and energy requiring anabolism. So it's taking what comes out of breaking things down to make itself, right? It's taking what gets broken down to make it. Often catabolism occurs in one part of a cell while synthetic reactions take place in another, such as the endoplasmic reticulum or within the cytosol itself. So as I said, catabolism is the breaking down of molecules and polymers into simple forms. Catabolism releases energy that is captured by phosphorylating ADP to produce ATP. An important area of catabolism occurs. Catabolism or breaking down of things happen within the Krebs cycle, glycolysis in the electron transport chain, which we'll be discussing here very shortly. Anabolism combines simple molecules and monomers to make more complex ones. Okay? So I always use the apple as an example. You have a solid apple. You bite chunks of it. You chew it into a mush. It goes down into your tummy where it gets further broken down, and sugar chains get broken apart and so forth, getting down into smaller and smaller sugars. And as that passes through the gut, those simple sugars get absorbed by the body and utilize that energy of the sugars to further then create this ATP molecule as one particular thing that it does. So ATP, we have to remember, it's vitally important because it's absolutely utilized in muscle activity. So you're all using it right now just simply by writing, drawing, typing, blinking, breathing, whatever it may be. You're using ATP to do that in some cases. Secretion by some glands. So some glands do require some, shall we say, contraction to force substances out. Maintenance of membrane potentials. And I'm going to be coming back to this quite a bit, even in Clinical Anatomy 1, when I talk about the physiology of muscle contraction. There is a deliberateness in physiology with cells to maintain membrane potentials, meaning that there's more of something on one side than the other. In other words, the cells are always trying to maintain a more positive environment outside the cell membrane and a more negative environment inside the cell membrane. And as we know through the properties of diffusion, of course, if it's more positive outside, those ions want to balance on either side of that membrane at any given time. So energy is utilized to pump ions in an appropriate manner to maintain this differential. That will make sense shortly. Absorption of food from the gastrointestinal tract, of course, is another thing that ATP is used for. ATP plays a role in making the energy of foods available for all these purposes. It is labile, which means it's unstable and it breaks apart quite easily from a chemical perspective. It's not too difficult to break apart, and thank goodness it isn't, because that would require some changes in physiology. ATP is in a combination of adenine, ribose, and 3-phosphate radicals. The last 2-phosphate radicals are connected with the remainder of the molecule by high energy bonds. Now, when I say this, we have to understand that, and I'm not going to get complicated in drawing on the board here, but fundamentally, we say adenosine triphosphate tells you how many phosphate molecules are there. Correct. Okay. So between each one, actually, maybe I'll use red. It'll be easier to see from a distance. We're just going to do this. Oh, that doesn't work really darn now, does it? These ones are here. I was going to use them, but they might be kind of shot. Okay, so I'm just going to put phosphate molecules here. I'm not going to worry about the adenosine at the moment. In between, holy cow. Don't know what, how is my battery low? I just plugged it in. Good Lord. These red are high energy bonds. Okay, so between each of these molecules, there's a high energy bond. And we say that ATP is a combination of these, and the last two phosphate radicals are connected with the remainder of the molecule by high energy bonds, here and here. The amount of free energy in each of these bonds is 12,000 calories per mole. Does that blow anybody here away? Think of that. When's the last time you ate 12,000 calories in a day? Never. Okay? The way I kind of liken it to, and it's a bit different, I get it, but what happened when we split the atom? Boom. We flattened a whole city, an atom that's smaller than that. Okay? Lots of energy exists in the molecular level. So you have to understand that by having a high energy bond between two phosphate molecules, when I separate the second and the third phosphate molecules, we release 12,000 calories per mole. That energy is what contracts our muscles, makes your heart beat, makes your eyes blink, makes your neurons work to send messages around the body, and so on and so forth. So it's mind-blowing. Here's the thing, though. You don't use all 1,200 calories. What happens when you're burning a lot of ATP, when, like, for example, you're out for a run? You get, why do you sweat? Because you get hot. Because that energy is not all utilized, only part of it is, and that energy gets released, works its way in through the body and heats you up. That's why you get hot when you work out. You're processing all this ATP, releasing all this energy so that your muscles can contract when you go for a run, but it's inefficient. But if our houses were as efficient as the capture of the energy, we'd be so happy, our gas bills would be nothing. But it's still inefficient, so therefore, even though those calories are being utilized for you to go for a run, lots of those calories aren't being utilized, and they have to, that energy needs to be dealt with because there's a byproduct of heat production. Okay? So 12,000 calories per mole. How big is a mole? What's the definition of a mole? Do you remember? Yeah, it's 12,000. I missed the zero. It is that high. It's not the other way, 1,200. It's actually 12,000. It's a lot. Therefore, each of these radicals liberates 12,000 calories of energy every time we split them apart. So we have to create ATP so that ATP can be split apart to release the energy for normal physiological functions to occur that require ATP to be done. Does that make sense to everybody? Right? Yeah, so whenever we have, well, as I said in the first slide, okay, I'm just going to do this. This might make things just a bit easier. I'm going to put an adenosine here. Okay, so we've got adenosine and two phosphates would be what? Right, it would be ADP because there's two phosphate molecules here. Okay, so when we're thinking about what's happening when we're creating ATP, the body has to take phosphate molecule that's way over here floating around, and it has to bond the second and the third. So think of it this way. So you've got one, two, and three. Okay? So when we bond that third phosphate, it becomes a triphosphate, ATP. Okay? So that means that within physiological processes, the mitochondria is constantly bonding the second to the third, and the body is constantly breaking apart the second from the third, using that energy for every function that occurs in the body. Okay? So there's a process by which we bond the second and third, and then there's enzymes that are involved. to split the second and the third, thus releasing 12,000 calories and utilizing that energy to many, many processes that the body uses. Okay? Any questions on that? Yes. Quite, yeah, over and over again until they get worn out, then they get replaced again. Yep, always. And it'll all make sense shortly, trust me. ATP is present everywhere in the cytoplasm and nucleoplasm of all cells, and essentially all of the physiological mechanisms that require energy for operation obtain it from ATP. In turn, the food in the cells is gradually oxidized, and the released energy is used to reform ATP, thus maintaining a constant supply. So if I get so simple as to say you eat a Macintosh apple, it's sweet, there's those sugars, they contain energy, the body breaks down those sugars to gain the energy to bond the second and the third phosphate. It's not that simple, but for us it's that simple. That's ultimately what's happening, okay? So, carbohydrate metabolism. Polysaccharides and disaccharides are broken down into monosaccharides, glucose, sucrose, and galactose. In other words, what I'm saying is complex carbohydrates. You've all heard that term before, right? Complex carbohydrates, right? You should eat more complex carbohydrates, right? That's your apple and your banana and so forth. There are sugars in there are called polysaccharides. Polysaccharides aren't that functional inside the human body. They need to be broken down into their smallest component, which is a monosaccharide. So whenever you eat an apple, I'll keep going to the apple, lots of sugars in there, you know, you can taste it, right? Those polysaccharides need to be broken down into glucose, sucrose, and galactose, one of those three. And it is those monosaccharides that the body utilizes for its purposes. So again, apple's got polys, and we need to break those down into monos. Okay? Glucose represents the greater amount of these. So the majority of what we have utilized is glucose. And of course, it runs in the blood because we can measure it. And if you have a problem with glucose in the blood, you are a diabetic. Okay? So you're not metabolizing glucose appropriately, or you're not getting glucose out of the blood into the cells to maintain the appropriate levels in the blood. Okay? So you, glucose, and by the way, the little gray matter up here, it exclusively uses glucose to function. Doesn't use anything else. Okay? That's why you can get all funky, you know, when your sugars are down, because the brain is just devouring sugar like crazy. These monosaccharides are absorbed into the portal system, which involves the liver, and after passing through blood sinuses of the liver, they're carried to everywhere in the body by the circulating system. Now, we've got glucose, okay? Glucose is floating around out there. We have to get glucose into the cell because it's in the cell that ATP is created. So I want you to understand that when we're talking about, you know, building ATP, we're in the mitochondria in every cell in your body. So the fuel source is mainly the monosaccharide glucose, so it's got to get in the cell in order to provide the energy to create ATP. Everybody follow me so far? Yeah? We're okay there? Okay. So, they have to, the glucose has to be transported to the cell membrane into the cytoplasm. Now, monosaccharides are water soluble, so therefore they can't. Right. They can't diffuse through the membrane because of the hydrophobic lipid tails, right? Phospholipids. So how do we get it in? Well, we already talked about how we have ligand integral proteins. Do you remember that? Right? So there's a receptor on integral protein that passes through the membrane. Remember, integral proteins have an exposure outside the cell and inside the cell. So insulin comes along, and the insulin hormone stimulates the ligand on the integral protein, which then allows the glucose to enter into the cell. So, remember that a monosaccharide cannot diffuse through the cell membrane, it's too large. They enter the cytoplasm with a carrier protein via facilitated diffusion. Remember, that's the ligand kind because we need the hormone out of the pancreas, insulin, in order for that to happen. What's interesting is once in the cytoplasm, it breaks away from that protein carrier. So insulin stimulates every cell in the body that has that integral protein, and those cells allow glucose in. Now, glucose can, without insulin, it can wiggle in, and some glucose can enter a cell without it, but it's not enough. Another form of influence that drives glucose into cells is exercise. So this is why in individuals who have diabetes, when they exercise, they have to do some calculations because they can over-insulin themselves and drop their sugars too low. Whereas if they're just sitting around the house doing nothing all day, they would use a little more insulin, but when they're exercising, they use a little less. That's where the pumps come in, which are awesome. Okay, so the rate of glucose transport through the cell membrane is greatly increased by insulin. Insulin can increase as much as 10 or more times the rate than if there was no insulin present. And the amount of glucose that can diffuse in the absence of insulin, except for the liver and brain, are far too little to supply the amount of glucose normally required for energy metabolism. So diabetics, when their insulin is low, they can't drive enough glucose into cells. This is why they're lethargic and tired and cranky. Okay? Therefore, we can say that the rate of carbohydrate utilization of the body is controlled mainly by secretion of the pancreas through, of course, the release of the hormone insulin. Now, the glucose has come up to the integral protein through facilitated diffusion. It's been released into the inside of the cell. What's to stop the glucose from, through the influence of diffusion, what's to stop the glucose from exiting the cell to go back out? Because now maybe there's less glucose outside of the cell than inside of the cell. Is it fair to say that glucose would want to head back out to the outside of the cell because there's less glucose? Would the law of diffusion demand that? Would it? Right, because it wants to equalize. Well, we don't want glucose to leave. We want glucose to stay in the cell. So what happens is, the moment the glucose goes inside the cell, it is bound with a phosphate molecule. Once that glucose is bonded to a phosphate molecule, it cannot leave the cell. When we bind a phosphate molecule to the glucose molecule, we say it is phosphorylated. The moment that phosphate attaches onto that glucose molecule, we say that it is phosphorylated. So, when glucose immediately enters the cell, it combines with a phosphate radical. This phosphorylation is promoted by the enzyme glucokinase in the liver or hexokinase in most other cells. So we have to bind this phosphate molecule to the glucose. And of course, that's phosphorylation. Phosphorylation is almost completely irreversible except in the liver. So the liver has the opportunity to keep glucose inside the cells. But also at times of low glucose globally in the body, it can release glucose out to the body to help maintain the appropriate glucose levels in the blood that are required at any time. Remember, you have the possibility of having too much glucose in the bloodstream, which represents that one side, that diabetes, but you can also have low glucose levels in the blood at any given time because you're utilizing it. Hypoglycemia is low blood sugar. Hyperglycemia is high blood sugar. So hyperglycemia is when we start thinking that someone may be diabetic, but diabetics can also suffer from hypoglycemia through the use of insulin. They can get their blood sugars a bit too low. Low blood sugar is, you always know when someone's got low blood sugar. Your sweet little grandma who never says a bad word, she's diabetic and her sugars are low, start dropping the F-bomb and doing all sorts of things and get really mad and want to fight people and do all sorts of things. I've seen them come into the hospital. They're just completely cursing, swearing, yelling, screaming, kicking, fighting, or whatever. And they'll just drop a little bit of sugar into their blood in an IV bag, and bing, they're back to sweet little grandma again. Just like that. It's crazy because the brain requires glucose. Therefore, phosphorylation serves to capture the glucose in the cell, and therefore, once a glucose molecule is phosphorylated, it cannot escape. The phosphate molecule activates the protein, making it unstable and more readily available for chemical reactions, which we know is going to occur in the mitochondria because we said that glucose was the major fuel source to create ATP. Right? So we have to Remember, phosphorylation is the attachment of phosphate molecule to a compound. After glucose is absorbed into the cell, it can be immediately used for energy, or it can be stored in another form called glycogen. Okay, now glycogen is it's stored in only in vast amounts in a couple of areas. So some cells can store large amounts, especially in the liver, which can store 5 to 8% of their weight, and muscle cells that can store 1 to 3% of their weight. Right? When we form glycogen, it's called glycogenesis. Now, glycogen is a sugar form that muscles use to create ATP, especially in an anaerobic environment when there's no oxygen, right? How many people here have done sports and had to do A's and B's or wind sprints and all that kind of stuff, right? Just about throwing up every time, wondering why the coach is doing it to you. The reason is when you do wind sprints, you're actually forcing muscles to store more glycogen, more sugar in the muscle. And therefore, over time, you won't feel as depleted when you work hard. So if you're in a sport like basketball, where you're doing a lot of wind sprints or hockey, that kind of stuff, we deliberately want to tax the muscles to force them to store more glycogen and fatigue levels diminish and you're able to deal with the aspects of those sports without conking out because you've got more storage of sugars in there. I kind of always say glycogen, I kind of call it muscle sugar, right? Because it's the stored form of glucose in the muscle. All cells of the body are capable of storing some amounts, but again, the liver and skeletal muscle are kind of the major area where you get it. All right? That's the first slide. Maybe I should wipe my board off here because I have a feeling I'd be doing a bit of drawing and writing. So some key things to remember, when we're looking at this, remembering it's glucose. Remember that we have the two membranes inside and outside the mitochondria, smooth on the outside, convoluted on the inside. And remember that we had to phosphorylate that glucose molecule to have it stay in the cell. So glucose is the preferred source for synthesizing ATP, as I've said. For glucose to be used by body cells, it must first pass through the plasma membrane, enter the cytosol through facilitated diffusion, which we discussed. Insulin increases the rate, and glucose entry is always turned on in neurons and hepatocytes. So glucose is always quite welcome into neurons and liver cells. Once glucose enters it, we say it's phosphorylated, which prevents it from exiting the cell. So those are some key points to think about. Now we now have a glucose molecule that has been phosphorylated. In other words, we have a glucose molecule that is attached to a phosphate. It's now in the cell. We now have to break that glucose down to access its energy. The oxidation of glucose is known as cellular respiration. So this breaking down of the glucose molecule, it's oxidized, so oxygen, O2 is somewhat used. It's known as cellular respiration. There are four steps that we need to be concerned with. The first is glycolysis. The second is the formation of something called acetyl coenzyme A. The third is what's known as the Krebs cycle. And the fourth is utilization of the compounds from the Krebs cycle by something called the electron transport chain. I'm sure many of you have heard of the Krebs cycle. How many of you have heard about the electron transport chain? A few of you? Good. Do you still remember it? Nope. Okay. All right. Let's do glycolysis first. This is always the first step to release energy from glucose. So even whether it's anaerobic metabolism, meaning creation of ATP without the presence of oxygen, or whether it's aerobic metabolism, creating ATP in the presence of oxygen, you still always need this first step. So this is the most important means of energy release from the glucose molecule. This is followed by the oxidation of the end product of glycolysis. Basically, when we say glycolysis, it's the splitting of the glucose molecule to form two molecules of pyruvic acid, also known as pyruvate. So we have to take that glucose molecule and we have to split it to form two molecules of pyruvic acid. Okay? Everybody got with me still? one glucose, two pyruvate. All right? Now, this is done through 10 successive steps of chemical reactions. And each step requires an enzyme, and enzymes are proteins. Right? You see, more science, more you realize, like proteins is everything in the human body. Okay? So we have enzymes that through 10 steps takes that glucose molecule and creates 2 pyruvate. Right? Each step, glycolysis utilizes 2 molecules of ATP to produce 4 ATP for a net gain of 2. So ATP is actually required in these steps to create ATP. So 2 ATP are required in the process to form 4 ATP. So therefore, we have a net in production of 2. Okay? In the first 3 reactions, it involves the addition of a phosphate group. So there's continuing phosphorylation to glucose, its conversion to fructose, and the addition of another phosphate group to fructose. This process involves energy in which 2 molecules of ATP are converted to ADP. Because we have to remember when I wrote the circles on there, we diphosphate and triphosphate, so ATP and ADP are always flipping back and forth. Right? We're always building ATP so that when we remove a phosphate, we create ADP, but we also release the energy that's required to do processes. Everybody following me so far? Okay. So, the doubly phosphorylated molecule of fructose, right? We had an addition of a phosphate group to glucose, its conversion to fructose, and the addition of another phosphate group to fructose. So it is doubly phosphorylated. It splits into 2-3 carbon compounds and undergoes further reactions to become pyruvic acid. It's okay. Smooth those wrinkles. It's okay. Because no, it's your because you're doing the okay. So we've doubly phosphorylated the fructose, right? And that fructose splits into 2-3 carbon compounds that go through a couple more reactions again to create pyruvic acid. The key thing you need to understand here is we phosphorylated the glucose once it got into the cell. We then, through chemical steps and putting another phosphorylation in the mix, we have taken a glucose molecule and created 2 pyruvic acids, okay? That's what you really need to take away here. Now, we also create something called NADH. Don't worry about what NA and D and H stand for. Just understand it's NADH. We create 2 of those. So in this process of taking glucose to create 2 pyruvic acid, we have created 2 pyruvic acid and also 2 NADH. That will come back a little bit later. Yes. The 10 successive steps that take you from glucose to 2 pyruvic acid also gives you 2 NADH. Okay? So the last 4 steps, 4 more ATP are produced as our 2 molecules of pyruvic acid. Remember, though, we needed to use 2 ATP in order to create the 4 ATP. Therefore, we only had net gain of 2. Why, Brian? Why? Does anybody here love this stuff as much as I do? Okay. We haven't seen oxygen yet, have we? Have I used the term oxygen yet, really much? No. So, because the process hasn't required oxygen yet, so therefore, this is said to be anaerobic. This is done without the presence of oxygen. So therefore, this point right now, glucose to 2 pyruvic acid and 2 NADH is said to be anaerobic cellular respiration without oxygen respiration. Yes. Three carbon. So there's 3 carbons. Those carbons are going to come back a little bit later too. They are going to play an important role as a byproduct in the Krebs cycle. So understanding that, do I say this? I don't want to confuse you guys. There's a number of chemical steps that occur in the Krebs cycle. We're not going to have to know them, but we're going to have to understand it's the rejigging of the amount of carbons to create new compounds. So carbons always play a role. So what we're saying is, We take the doubly phosphorylated fructose and we split it into two, three carbon compounds. So each compound has three carbons in it. Okay? Yeah. It is. There's no oxygen done yet. Okay? Don't get caught up in it. It's okay. Sorry, don't get caught up in that. Now, the pyruvic acid, it's going to go two different ways. And it completely depends on whether or not there's oxygen present at this point. In other words, the fate of pyruvic acid depends on the availability of oxygen. If oxygen really isn't around much, the pyruvic acid is reduced by the addition of two hydrogen atoms to form lactic acid. So when there is no oxygen present, remember, how many ATP did it produce? No, it produced four, but used two, okay? So if there's no oxygen present, we're done. Those two pyruvic acids will be broken down, well, not broken down, have addition of hydrogen atoms that will turn it into lactic acid. And everybody hears it lactic acid, right? Okay, as a byproduct. Especially in anaerobic metabolism, such as weight training, right? The idea is that you're not using that much oxygen when you're doing strength training. It's relatively anaerobic, so byproduct of strength training is always lactic acid. Sprinting, right? Doing 100 meters, fast, hard sprints, that's anaerobic metabolism to do that sort of thing. So we're having a byproduct of lactic acid. How many people here, you lift weights, you get into those last couple of reps, and it's burning really badly? Why? Because you've produced lactic acid and the environment inside the muscle is actually acidic. Here's the thing, the lactic acid does not cause muscle soreness the next day. Lactic acid is completely metabolized and gone within seconds after it builds up in the muscle. Yes? Yep. Yep. Yes. A little bit. So they're more anaerobic in nature, which means that's what's occurring inside that muscle. We're going to get into that in clinical anatomy one. So we're going to talk about fast twitch, SOG fibers, FA fibers. There's different kinds of fibers, and they all metabolically create their energy differently. They're either anaerobic fibers or aerobic fibers or a mix of both. And that, of course, would completely involve what we're talking about here in terms of how their ATP is done. Anaerobically, doesn't make very many ATP, does it? Four with a net gain of two. This is why when you're anaerobically sprinting 100 meters down a track, you can't go much farther than 100 meters because you're done. Anybody here do 200s? Any 200 specialists here? Yeah, what do you do at the 100-meter mark? You carry your speed, which means that you've completely burned your fuel. And you just can't try to keep those legs turning over at the same speed, and it hurts, doesn't it? Right? If you ever watch, pay attention. You watch the 200 meters in the Olympics or in world-class track events, the 200-meter runners pretty much always collapse at the end. They can't stand anymore because they have no energy sources left to control muscle function. So the fate of pyruvic acid depends on the availability of oxygen. If there isn't any or very little, pyruvic acid is reduced by the addition of two hydrogen atoms to form lactic acid. Now, the other thing, when this happens, it regenerates a compound called NAD when it allows glycolysis to continue. What happens is we produce the lactic acid, and as we know, lactic acid does build up to some degree in muscle, hence the reason why the muscle can't function. So what happens to that lactic acid? It diffuses out of the cell rapidly, enters the blood, goes to the liver, and is converted back to pyruvic acid. Pretty cool, eh? So therefore, pyruvic acid could come back and create... Right. Very efficient, yes? Okay. So I'm going to dispel some myths now in terms of lactic acid. All this talk about lactic acid causing muscle soreness after exercise and all that kind of stuff. No. Right, we now know that delayed onset of muscle shortening, everybody heard this term before, or muscle soreness, DOMS, is actually a reaction of micro-inflammatory damage and repair that's happening after you train. Right? That's basically what it is. And yeah, and massage doesn't help it, unfortunately, even though we think it does for some people. So when oxygen is present, though, and here's the key thing. So we've gone a couple of steps here. Glucose has gone in the cell. It's passed through the cell. It's been phosphorylated. That glucose, through 10 successive steps, has become pyruvic acid. No oxygen, pyruvic acid, which has created 4 ATP for a net gain of 2, converts to lactic acid, and off it goes into the bloodstream to become pyruvic acid again. But we need a lot of ATP, correct? So if there's oxygen present, which is vitally important, because we're going to learn the Krebs cycle makes a larger, through its association with the electron transport chain, makes a larger number of ATP as compared to the anaerobic form. If there's oxygen present at the time we have the pyruvic acid is converted to coenzyme A. For short, we call it CoA. So if there's no oxygen, pyruvic acid becomes lactic acid. It's a bit of a, shall we say, a bad byproduct. It needs to be shipped out and converted. But if there's oxygen present, the pyruvic acid is changed through chemical reactions to something called coenzyme A or CoA. Coenzyme A is required to enter into the Krebs cycle to produce a larger number of ATP. So because we required oxygen to convert pyruvic acid into coenzyme A, we are now into aerobic metabolism. Everybody follow me so far? Yeah. Well, it does to some degree, but the key thing for us at this point is that when the glucose is broken down into the pyruvic acid through its steps, right? If there's no oxygen, we're done with it. It gets converted to lactic acid and gets shipped out. Okay, done. Finished with it. And then it gets changed back to pyruvic acid in the liver, and it could end up anywhere. Okay. If there's oxygen present, pyruvic acid is converted to coenzyme A, and now we can move into aerobic metabolism. So everything up to lactic acid is anaerobic metabolism. If there's oxygen present, we're going to convert to acetyl coenzyme A, and then now we can step into the aerobic part of creating ATP. Does that make more sense? Does that make sense? Okay. So remember that without oxygen, the pyruvic acid is converted to lactic acid, where it goes to the liver to be converted to pyruvic acid. It happens rapidly. In the presence of oxygen, pyruvic acid is converted into acetyl-CoA or acetyl-coenzyme A. Now, a coenzyme is a substance that enhances or is necessary for the action of enzymes. So think of it as a precursor to enzymes. A coenzyme is a precursor to the enzyme. This is derived from pantothenic acid, a B vitamin. So one of the things you find when you delve into metabolic reactions in the body, some of it, because I used to teach a nutrition course, it used to be actually part of our curriculum years ago, you start realizing why some of these things we need to eat or have in our diet is vitally important to normal processes in the body. In this case, vitamin B, right? So we require pantothenic acid, which is a B vitamin, in order to have some of these things occur. This is done in the presence of oxygen to prepare the pyruvic acid for the Krebs cycle in the mitochondria. So pyruvic acid is useless to the Krebs cycle. It needs to be converted to coenzyme A, and what helps that is this pantothenic acid. We have to remember that we created two pyruvic acid when we broke that single glucose molecule down once it entered into the cell and was phosphorylated. Yes? Yeah? Okay. The two derivative molecules of pyruvic acid must be converted into two molecules of acetyl-CoA. And this is done by removing one CO2 molecule and two hydrogen atoms from each pyruvic acid molecule. Now, I am not going to ask questions on that, so you can relax right now. I'm not going to do this, but you just need to understand what's happening here. Because we need to know that CO2 and hydrogen, these things, they're going to come around quite a few times in this whole process, okay? And they're, especially the hydrogen, is vitally important because we need hydrogen in the later steps, okay? So this is done. We convert pyruvic acid to acetyl-CoA by removing one CO2 molecule and two hydrogen atoms from each pyruvic acid molecule. Now, by converting pyruvic acid to acetyl-CoA, it is now a chemical that can enter the Krebs cycle. Okay? So, the Krebs cycle. It is also known as the citric acid cycle or the tricarboxylic acid cycle. It is a sequence of nine biochemical reactions in which the acetyl portion of the acetyl-CoA is degraded to carbon dioxide and hydrogen. Please highlight that part, degraded to highlight carbon dioxide and hydrogen, or somehow mark it for yourself, because they're going to come back, especially the hydrogen. All right? So we have to break it down. Nine reactions in which that acetyl portion of the acetyl-CoA is degraded to carbon dioxide and hydrogen atoms. All of this is occurring, which we're about to talk about, occurs in the matrix of the mitochondria. Where do we find the matrix? Anybody remember where the matrix is? Sorry? In the inner, in the inner. So the inner is convoluted, and within those convolutions is the fluid called the matrix. So this is occurring in there, in that inside part, okay? This is occurring there. The released hydrogen is oxidized, which releases large amounts of energy to produce ATP, and we'll get to where that happens a little bit later. What's really neat about this whole nine steps is that the steps begin, and I always pronounce it differently, and I don't remember how would it pronounce for you. I call it oxaloacetic acid. What do they call it? They pronounce it a bit differently, or did they use the same term? They did the same. Okay. The British pronounce it a bit differently. So the cycle begins with oxaloacetic acid and ends with the formation of oxaloacetic acid. So therefore, the cycle can run indefinitely. It's one of the cool things about it. There's all, you know, we've got nine steps occurring here, but the initial compound is oxaloacetic acid, and it goes through all these changes. The carbons change. There's the release of hydrogen, oxygen, right? There's all kinds of stuff, and then it comes all the way around the circle and becomes oxaloacetic acid again. So it can be used again and again and again. And again and again. Okay? The cycle, though, cannot begin until we have an acetyl group that's attached to the coenzyme A. This is the Krebs cycle. It'll be on the quiz next week. I'm kidding. But what I want you to, there's some key things I want you to take from this diagram. The first is oxaloacetic acid ends. Oxaloacetic acid begins. That's the first thing. The next thing is, how much water do you see there? Right? These chemical reactions result in the production of water. What else do you see there? Carbon, lots of carbon changes, right? Right? Okay. And what else do you see in the little squares and circles? Hydrogen and carbon dioxide. So this is where the carbon dioxide comes from when you need to breathe hard when you're exercising. Because the byproduct of the creation of ATP in the Krebs cycle is carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is acidic. So too much of it and you go into what's called acidosis and you can die. You can change your pH inside your body. So why do we breathe hard when we exercise? You probably all thought it's because you need more oxygen. Is actually to get rid of carbon dioxide. That's why you breathe harder when you exercise. Because you're starting to compound and build up carbon dioxide through the creation of ATP in the Krebs cycle. Right? This is where it's all coming from. The other thing to hang on to as well is 2, 4, 6, 8, there's 10 hydrogen atoms there, yes? They're going to become imperative in the next step known as the electron transport chain. There's 8 hydrogen. Right, 10 hydrogen atoms that are created in this process. Right, we've got pyruvic acid up previously, and then through the citric acid cycle, we're also producing hydrogen atoms as well, and they're going to be vitally important in the next step, which is the electron transport chain. Okay, that's where they come from. But from my perspective, I just want you to understand: lots of water, lots of hydrogen, right? And begins and ends with the same compound. I'm not asking you to break down all the chemical reactions that it takes from what to what to what to what. Not for this course. So, we can see it here a little bit easier. These are the changes that occur, and we can see here that it is the interaction between the coenzyme and oxaloacetic acid that goes then to citrate, then isocitrate, to ketoglutarate, the succinyl coenzyme A, succinate, fumarate, malate, and back to oxaloacetic acid. So I just want you to understand that you get these chemical reactions that converts the compounds that begins with oxaloacetic acid and ends with oxaloacetic acid, and that the pyruvic acid in the presence of oxygen converted to coenzyme A, and is the reaction of the coenzyme A and the oxaloacetic acid that starts to run through the cycle, producing water, carbon dioxide, and hydrogen. Is that a lot easier than the last time you took it? Gibberish? Gibberish. So, the remaining, so let's go back again. So we say here, we have to have an acetyl group that's attached to the coenzyme, okay? Acetyl coenzyme. The remaining coenzyme is released and can be reused for the formation of still more quantities of acetyl-CoA to form pyruvic acid. So we have to go back here and say, we need the acetyl group for this whole cycle to start. The CoA breaks from the acetyl group and can go back and grab another one from two other pyruvic acids that have been going to be converted in the presence of oxygen. Well, we're only talking about one glucose molecule here. How many glucose molecules do you think there actually are at any given time? Like a lot. Okay? But we've got it down to one. How confused are we all at this point? So what do you need? I thought I did. Well, let's go the steps all the way from the beginning. Okay, so you eat an apple, right? It's a disaccharide or polysaccharide, lots and lots and lots of chains in it. It's useless for us to use. We have to make a polysaccharide into a monosaccharide to be functional for the body to utilize. So we take it down to one of those three that we talked about, with glucose being the most popular. So glucose is now floating in the blood, and we need to get glucose in the cell because it can't pass through the membrane well because it's a water-soluble compound. So insulin stimulates an integral protein, and through facilitated diffusion, the glucose travels into the inside of the cell. Once inside of the cell, the first thing that happens to it, there is a chemical reaction that binds a phosphate molecule to the glucose. So we say that the glucose is now phosphorylated, and the glucose can't leave. Okay? Now, glucose can go one of two ways. If the cell isn't requiring the vast amounts of energy that all the glucose molecules have within the cell, it'll be converted to a compound called glycogen, which is a stored form of glucose. Glycogen can be converted back to glucose anytime the cell requires glucose in order to create ATP. Does that make sense to everybody? So it can go back and forth. So if it doesn't need it, it goes to glycogen. Glucagon's entirely something different. To convert to glycogen, if the cell requires energy and there's not enough glucose coming in, it'll convert the glycogen back to glucose. Okay? Now, glucose, through 10 steps, needs to become something that can be utilized. When we convert the initial glucose to become pyruvic acid, it is in a low oxygen environment, so it's said to be anaerobic, and that process to convert the pyruvic acid, to break down the glucose into pyruvic acid, produces 4 ATP. And as we said, it takes 2 ATP in order to create the 4. Okay? So, we haven't got any oxygen. We've taken glucose and we've made pyruvic acid. Now, we're oxygen breathing individuals, so we are going to move into oxygen metabolism. Okay? So we're going to go to into aerobic metabolism. So if there's no oxygen, that pyruvic acid is going to be converted to lactic acid, and off it goes for the liver to be processed. Okay? And that can go on and on and on and on and on. Right? Glucose can keep coming into the cell. The glucose can continue to be broken down into pyruvic acid, and that conversion from glucose to pyruvic acid does give us 4-ATP. So it does give the body, anaerobically, it does give the body some ATP over and over and over and over again. And of course, the byproduct of that, of converting glucose without oxygen into pyruvic acid, is constantly giving us a byproduct of lactic acid, and we need to get rid of it because accumulations of lactic acid unfortunately do shut down, right, the cell or whatever's going on. So it's got to go. But if you think about it, from a point of view of energy consumption, anaerobic metabolism really doesn't produce a vast amount of ATP. So we need to move into the presence of oxygen to go into aerobic metabolism in order to produce a vast amount more of ATP. Does everybody remember what the Krebs cycle and electron transport chain, how many ATP molecules are normally produced? Keep going. Because there's two pyruvic acids, 16 per equals 32. Okay, so lots more. All right, so we've got the sequences, and we've broken it down. Now in oxygen, rather than the pyruvic acid being turned to lactic acid, it goes into acetyl coenzyme A. Because acetyl coenzyme A is a chemical that's required to enter into the Krebs cycle. Yes? Maybe? I'm hoping. It just said that I'm running out of power. Yeah, I know that. I know. Just let me check this because I just went, oh no, don't die on me now. No, it's still working. It's a great question because I'm like, oh no. Okay. So, why didn't I understand why it doesn't follow it? I am going to move a bit forward because it might clear up some of the other stuff, right? So we now have oxygen. It's gone into acetyl coenzyme A. Okay. Now, the remaining CoAs released can be reused for the formation of more quantities of acetyl CoA. The acetyl portion becomes an integral part of the citric acid molecule. Pyruvic acid, in the presence of oxygen, was converted into the acetyl coenzyme A. Acetyl coenzyme A snuggles up to oxaloacetic acid. Drops off the acetyl group, okay, and so the remaining CoA is released and can be used. So the acetyl group attaches with the oxaloacetic acid, and the coenzyme buggers off to the next two pyruvic acids that are going to be converted to acetyl CoA in the presence of oxygen. Does that make sense? Right. So the coenzyme brings the acetyl group over. Like to introduce you to Mr. Oxaloacetic Acid. How you doing? And they begin the process, and the coenzyme heads off and grabs, a couple more, because there's two, right? Because glucose, a single glucose is converted to two pyruvic acid, which then become two acetyl coenzyme A. One to two, right? One to two. Okay. All right. During the stages of the Krebs cycle, as I showed you, several molecules of water are added and CO2 and H are released. So there's water here, and we've got hydrogen, and we've got carbon dioxide. In the next eight successive steps, remember there were nine steps to the Krebs cycle. We started with oxaloacetic acid, and we have this first reaction, okay? In the next eight successive steps, the atoms of citric acid are rearranged to produce different intermediate molecules and most are called keto acids. You don't need to know what they are, just understand they're all different types of acids, keto acids. The acidic acid is broken down carbon by carbon. So we take it and we break things down by carbon. This is called decarboxylated. So the compounds are decarboxylated. So the atoms are removed, changing the compounds, okay? And simultaneously, and well, the reason I'm putting this in, I know it seems complicated, but again, key point here. The acidic acid is broken down carbon by carbon. It's decarboxylated and it is oxidized, and this simultaneously creates NADH hydrogen and FADH2. They're going to come back a bit later. So the purpose of the Krebs cycle is to produce NADH and FADH and hydrogen. Write that down somewhere. It'll simplify it for you. The Krebs cycle's big responsibility is to create NADH, FADH, and hydrogen. Hydrogen. Because they're going to come back into the next steps. Yes. And also release. So you have both. You have water and release of water, release and use of water to break down. Because remember, water is a universal solvent, so it helps break things down within these compounds. Okay? Plus hydrogen and FADH2. Okay? You don't need to know what they stand for, just understand them. At the end of the cycle, acetic acid has been completely disposed of, and oxaloacetic acid is regenerated, the pickup molecule. That's the thing to remember about oxaloacetic acid. It picks up the acetyl group of the coenzyme A and starts the chemical reactions to come back again. You know why? Now you know why I left it? And now you know why I didn't record it? Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay, I'm going to leave it at that. I highly recommend read it in the book. I know I can tell some of you have not looked at this in the book. Yeah, I really got to look at this in the book, right? So this may make you happy or not happy. I'm kind of thinking I probably won't have a quiz when we come back because I don't know if there's enough information here to really build a quiz. Yes, you have a quiz on Wednesday, son. Wasn't it? Are you sure? If there isn't, then I won't do one.